Hi, I'm Tim Lynch from Green Planet FM here in Auckland, and I am speaking with Lise Groot-Albert.
Hello, Tim. It is so good to meet you.
Excellent. We're going to do well. Lise, you have been involved near on 30 years working with people who are sick, who are ill, terminally ill, and also with death and dying. How did you become involved in this way of life?
Well, Tim, the involvement came out of my own pain, really. Although I was very interested from very early on in working with other people and in the relationships between people, there was a big journey in my life that happened in 1972. In 1972, we lost our daughter. She died. She was nearly three. And she died 2 days after the birth of our son. And after that, we had another daughter. And what happened was, I lived that whole, and we lived together, that whole piece of hope and despair, and joy and sorrow, and light and dark, and, you know, and being with both of those. And at the time, it was really hard for people around in knowing how to react. On the one hand, there was this joyous little one, and on the other hand, our three-year-old had died, and people didn't know what to do, and it became really tough, because often when I was sad, people around me would put our little son in my arm and say, "Here, you have to get on with it." So that's what I did. I got on with it, and I thought one way to deal with my pain, and this was not conscious, this was really going on a subconscious level. I thought, if I fix everybody else, I become a super-duper therapist, I'll fix everybody else, and I'll feel much better inside myself. Well, of course, it doesn't work. So I burned out with a bang. And that's been a curse and a blessing, really. And after my burnout, and that's been a long time ago now, realizing that I could make a choice. And the choice I could make was to make the rest of my life a prison with the pain and the despair, or make it a school and learn from that and turn that into fertilizer and see what could grow out of that. So now I've been doing the work for a very long time out of a place of choice, and I feel very privileged, really. Yeah.
Because one of the things of life, of course, is birth and death. Mm. And we always want to be joyous around this birth. However, death is for everybody in the end, and going through the loss, the grief, and the pain, a lot of people, of course, don't know how to deal with it. It's like most men returning from the First World War and the Second World War coming back to New Zealand. They were very traumatized, and they did not know how to deal with all the loss and horror that they had seen, and so we're having to be able to find ways in which to release ourselves from all sorts of pain and horror that's happened to us. You have learnt particular ways in which to allow people to access their pain so that they can let go?
Yeah, the hard bit about it is that although over many, many years in research we've tried to develop techniques, the kind of 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, and if you do this, then you deal with your pain and you get through the loss and you can move on. I don't believe it works like that. I believe everybody in their own soul journey has a unique way of responding to loss. And loss and life go together. And so it is about being together and hanging out together and sitting together and seeing what are the ways that the person I'm working with has their strength and their depth and their resilience, and how can they deal with the loss they're facing at that time. So it's on the one hand quite individual, on the other hand also very culturally focused as well. And in the example you mention about the World War I or the World War II, veterans coming back and basically sucking it up, kind of closing down on the pain. Now, we know through research that for 20% of people, that might be the best way to do it, to continue living with their life, to not speak about it, to not have it delved into or dug up, and that can be really re-traumatizing. However, in 80% of people, and that's not only in the white Western world, for 80% of people to have community and care around them and be able to connect and speak and grieve and express their journey of sorrow and journey of pain makes for a lot of healing.
To have an intent to heal, we want to be able to heal, and then we have to have, or we need to have, people around us who can come in and are really soft and gentle with us to allow us to feel first safe.
Yeah.
And then things may sort of come out anyhow. It's just to allow that person to hold the space for them.
Yeah. That's right. And I think a lot of being with grief and loss and death and dying is about holding the space and being there and being connected. It really is when, and I think in many cultures I've worked in, that is such a key, that first what we do is we meet each other and we connect with each other and we take the time to be in that place of connectedness and developing a relationship. And after we do that, after we've done that, then something happens in the energy between us all. And in Samoa, for instance, where I have the privilege to work at the moment, Samoan people call that the va. It is that energy that is created between. And that is a very fertile and also a very sacred place where then, when that is well established, we can dance in our soul, in our heart and soul dance together. And the people who have this very painful dance at that time, this very difficult dance, this agonizing dance, feel safe enough to share that without feeling that they're not being heard or that we don't want to know or that it is crazy or that it is silly or anything like that.
Holding hands most probably is the most warmest thing we can do. If we cannot hug a person, but to just sit and hold their hand and touch their arm and make eye connection, and then everybody starts to feel far more safe and connected.
Yeah, and again, that is where culture comes in, because for some culture, it would not be appropriate to touch. For other cultures, it's like, if you don't touch, then there is a split. And also, within some cultures, it is not appropriate to really look at people and look people in the eye. But we can just connect with our skin and our heart and our eyes and our total attention and with our intellect as well. And so there are many ways of being in attention with the other and creating a platform where then together the medicine can happen. And that's a trial and error thing. I mean, we become clumsy in it and at times we get stuck in it, and that's what I do too. And then hopefully in having the willingness to stay connected and continue being in the awareness and the consciousness of what is happening, people are often very forgiving when, you know, when I'm clumsy with culture or I make mistakes or I say a silly thing or I do a silly thing. Yeah, people are very generous.
And, of course, tears and crying. We all know that crying can help wash away so much. It's something that, again, I think is very important in our process of healing, is to allow our tears to wash away.
And certainly, I mean, we're born, we see that with little ones, you know, when they throw their toy out of the cot, they cry. That is that kind of first little loss of being aware that life and loss go together. And our emotions are a God-given gift. And one of those is the grief and grieving and expressing that through tears. There are other ways of expressing it too. I mean, there is sometimes I've witnessed the wailing without the tears, or I've witnessed the singing, especially not that I personally witnessed this, but know that very clearly about the apartheid struggle in South Africa, where I remember hearing one woman say, "We can't afford to cry right now because we would go to pieces. So we will sing our grief. And in singing our grief, we can hold it together. And when the struggle is won, that's when we can cry." So there are many ways of expressing our loss. It might for some people be that they build something or make a garden or express, you know, in whatever way.
Lise, you were involved very early in the start with Elizabeth Kubler-Ross. And of course she came to New Zealand in 1986 and 1,600 people showed up at the Auckland Town Hall. And she connected with us so well. She told magnificent story about the tunnel, the lights, life after death. Can you explain to the listeners a little bit about what Elizabeth Kubler-Ross brought into the world? Because I feel it's always important to know that life, death and transition is a part of a greater picture.
Yeah, absolutely. I totally agree with that. Definitely. We cannot split things off. Eh? That is the reality. It is a continuation, not an end.
That's right.
You know, and in whatever way that is. Well, I had the privilege to meet with Elizabeth in 1987. And Elizabeth wrote her first book, On Death and Dying, in 1969. She wrote that in the States, and at the time there was very much the focus on what we call now first era medicine, which is seeing the body as a machine that when you take parts out or you put something in or you do whatever, then everybody's fixed. And thank God we are, I think, now in the third era medicine place, which is the place of looking at the whole person, mind, body, heart and soul, as well as that consciousness we're talking about that is really reaching through the third dimensional era and going into a much multidimensional level. Now, Elizabeth had a very clear understanding about that. And so what she did as an antidote to the belief system that started developing, especially in the United States and in the Western world, was that with medicine and with technology, we can fix everything. And she brought then, and because of that, death became unspeakable. It got tucked away in old people's homes, in hospitals, anywhere. And so what Elizabeth did in her writing, she said, "Wait a moment. It's not like this. Life's a terminal illness. We're all going to die, and we need to look at this." And I think what she really brought, and I really honor her for that as one of my teachers and one of the people who have gone before me and who I keep learning from, is that she always looked at the whole person in relation to the wider, whatever we want to call that, the divine consciousness. We have so many words about that. However, what's happened in recent times is she's been quite vilified, because what did stick in the psyche of people all around was her five stages, the 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, and which were, the denial, the bargaining, the anger, the grief, and the acceptance. And of course, what happened is people took it as a framework, as in a model, that you go through all five in a linear way, and at the end of it, everything's done and dusted, and it's finished, and you're fixed. Well, I've been with Elizabeth and had the privilege to work with her for many years, and it was never like that. She certainly didn't take that as a linear process. And it isn't a linear process. I mean, all those aspects can come up in grieving, in death and loss and transition. Not necessarily all of those will come up. There are people who never get angry. There are people who are not in denial, who, and by the way, I think there's a very healthy mechanism in that too. If we don't have denial at times, we just are not able to bear the pain. And that's a very important piece, I think.
You've mentioned soul a number of times, and of course, this is this is the crux of it.
Yeah,
is the essence of who we are inhabiting our body. Elizabeth gave a breakdown just prior to her death herself about how we go through a sort of a tunnel, and there could be guides or other beings through the doorway as well. And so it's for us really to realize that there's no finality. It's just a passing phase. It's like turning pages in a book, if we can be so prosaic about it. But life is sacred.
Yeah.
And yet we're only getting a small part of it.
Yeah, that's true. And I actually have two stories about that, which were both told to me by family. One was just the day before our daughter died. This was 1972. And our son had just been born. And Nana had been very clear about life and, really connected, like a lot of little ones are when we don't muck them around. Well, anyway, the day before she died, and she was very, very sick, and she had one possession, and her one possession was her teddy bear. And her teddy bear was called Pim. And that was, it's a kind of a transitional object most little ones have, and, and she clutched it always, this bear, and it went everywhere with her. And she was sitting, and she was already very sick, she said, was sitting on my husband's lap, and she leaned into him, and she looked up at him, and she looked down at the bear, and she looked up at him again. And she was still for a moment, and then she handed Pim, the bear, to my husband, and she said, "You can give Pim to Aiko, her little brother, because I don't need him anymore." And she died the next day. And to me and to all of us, on the one hand, it was agonizing. On the other hand, it was a message of hope as well. The sense that she knew and that she wasn't afraid and that it was okay. And it's been a real balm for us, actually. Yeah. And I think the little ones know. And so here is one more who has gone before us and who we continue to learn from, I think. And the other story was told, was an experience I had with my eldest granddaughter, Nikita, and I have permission to tell the story. Nikita is 11 now, but she was 5, and she hadn't seen snow, so I was going to take her to the mountain, to Mount Ruapeho, to see snow. So we had this wonderful, uninterrupted 4-hour journey from Auckland in the car, and she was sitting next to me in the car seat, and we had this great conversation about everything, like you do with a 5-year-old. Fabulous. So I was driving, and she was, and we were talking. She patted me on the arm at one stage. She was sitting next to me in her car seat, restrained, and she patted me on the arm, and she said to me, at a certain stage, halfway through the journey, "Beppe," and she calls me Beppe, that's Frisian for grandmother. And she said, "Beppe, you have to be quiet now, because I have to do some dreaming." So what do you do as a grandmother? You shut up, you know, that's how it is. And so I shut up, and I was driving, and I saw her breath changing and how her eyes turned inward, and she was dreaming. And I think it's so important that we allow our children to dream, to be in that reverie. So anyway, she was dreaming and I was driving and I was just marinating in that and having a fabulous time. And after about 10 minutes, she comes out of that place. I see her breath change again. Her eyes start to focus. She pats me on the arm again and she says, "Beppe, you can talk again because I finished dreaming." Well, anyway, I didn't have much to say, so we drove in silence just for a bit. And then she patted me on the arm and she said, "Beppe, did you see those crosses on the road?" And she meant the crosses that we put here in New Zealand by the side of the road when people have died. So I thought, ah, here is a conversation coming, and let me just not assume anything, but just ask the questions. So I said, "Yes, Kita, I saw those crosses on the road." She said, "Well, Beppe, there are dead people under there." I said, are there, Kita? Are there dead people under there? She said, yeah, they're dead, and the crosses go all the way into their bodies. All of five. By that time, I must have sounded a bit alarmed, and there must have been a bit of alarm in my voice when I said, do they, Kita? Do they go all the way into their bodies? And she looked at me, and she patted me on the arm again, quite patronizing, must I add. And she said, yes, Beppe, it's all right, don't worry about it. Because when you're dead, only your body is dead. And the one who you really are on the inside goes to God. Well, I thought, here's another one that doesn't need therapy when she's dealing with loss and grief. So that was perfect.
Yes, the children have a lot of answers for us, don't they? Particularly before they're seven.
Yeah.
I find their intuition and the magic that they can express.
Yeah.
Yes. And so with your work with Elizabeth Kubler-Ross, you moved on and you've been involved in palliative care, all sorts of ways in which to be able to assist people through change, through grief. Can you explain a little bit to the listeners what you have done? Of course, recently you've been up to Samoa, where, of course, the tsunami took many lives.
Yeah, I mean, in that way, my work is twofold. And that is, on the one hand, working immediately with families or with people individually or with community to deal with trauma, loss, grief, death and dying. And the other part of it is working with staff, working with healthcare professionals who are working with people at the end of life or who are working with people who've dealt with trauma, community who've dealt with trauma. And so with the second part of my work that has taken me to places like Zimbabwe and Malaysia and India and the Philippines and Samoa as well, that which is coming up, working with people who are working in palliative care and who are working at end of life with families, with community, with individuals. And so the main topics I tend to work with are topics about embracing difference as a bridge for connection, that we do not need to be of same culture to be able and stand in common ground, as long as we honor the other and stay connected and are clear about our own culture and our own thoughts and our own belief systems, so that the more clear I am about those, the less I need to leak them into your space, the less I need to proteselytize. Is that the word? You know, that kind of stuff.
Yes.
Yeah, absolutely. Here is where my English comes in. And, you know, or preach about my way is the best way. That's really, and so that's one way. And also what I have been working with is people is, in with healthcare professionals, is about how do you work with hope and despair? Because in order to be able to facilitate hope, you need to have the courage to sit with people in despair. Because it is in going through the pain and through the depth of feeling that often then people can find a new glimmer, a new energy, a new small connectedness with hope. And the other pieces I've been working with in that second place is around how do you care for yourself as healthcare professional. It is a bit like when we go into an aeroplane and it is a real clear message. Should oxygen be needed and the oxygen mask comes down, what you need to do is put on your own one first and then assist others who need assistance. And so it's about healer he thyself as well. So that's the work with healthcare professionals. And the work with people is really walking along with and doing a lot of listening and then hopefully facilitating some of exploring their strength, their resilience, what they have learned from having suffered losses before, in how they can be with that. And talking about and exploring their meaning of life. What is their place in life? What has been their purpose? What part of that feels intuitively like it has been fulfilled? What are the unfinished pieces, the unfinished business that maybe people can attend to before they die. And sometimes they can, and sometimes they can't. And there's no judgment in that either.
Mm. Over the years, of course, people used to die quite often in their homes, not in hospitals, because hospitals are a very recent thing, the last sort of 100 years in this country, 120 years. When people sort of died alone or in their home, we didn't have the big support structures. Now today, there is a lot more help available, but we still are in need of a lot more people who have an understanding of being able to assist people from their trauma. I mean, the government, through the Department of Health, has got certain facilities to assist people, but we need a lot more, don't we?
Yeah, I think that's true, that we need a lot more. There's a whole other piece in this where I think, and certainly I have learned a lot from Maori people here since I've been in New Zealand and have had the privilege to be invited into their lives and onto the marae, which is about community and connectedness. And I think the high level of isolation and despair that we see at times with people tends to come out of non-connectedness, when there is no sense of community anymore. Now, community can be also a curse and a blessing. I mean, you know, the reality is sometimes that when community always comes first, that is sometimes hard, and that being part of the community becomes a choiceless choice, whether we go for our own path in life or whether we choose a path that is supporting and energizing community. So I don't have any picture about that, but my sense is certainly, when talking from a white Western perspective, we have so focused on individuation, and with that isolation, with that also a sense of I am entitled to as an individual, and not creating that community sense anymore, that often people need to go to hospital or need to go to or are in an old people's home because there is not the community behind them. And that's a black and white statement, because there is, of course, also the reality that when people get very sick, we have magnificent hospices. We have magnificent facilities in the hospital who also are very open to palliative care here in New Zealand. And I think we're way ahead of many countries in the Western world in that sense, about paying attention to the quality of the journey of end of life instead of the quantity.
So I have had some experience myself with the hospital system here in New Zealand, and then moving also, going into retirement villages. And when you go inside some of these villages, all the facilities are superb. There's no shortage of modern technology and nice lounges and dining rooms, etc. And the staff are wonderful. There's some wonderful people who assist the elderly. And yet, of course, the other side of the coin is that a lot of medication is given to the elderly, and there's a concern around that. Sometimes I know up to 13 different medications are given to a person, and in many ways they become disconnected from everyone as well, because they're living in a swirl of drugs. And so I guess there's a need also for more natural means of health coming in as well. It's like they say that if these big homes had gardens in, that people could go out and work in and grow food, and the men could have a workshop, so that the men can get up out of bed next day and go down to a little workshop and play around and make things. It gives them more purpose, and so it revitalizes them and allows them to feel that they're still of use to themselves and also possibly of a community.
Yeah, and that is the reality, of course. You know, we can decide at the end of our life to wait until we die, or we can live until we die. And that is the piece, and really yes. Live until we die. And that means that in living until we die, where every day has meaning and where there is some purpose and there is some focus, and certainly doing things is very, very helpful and very important too. The feeling that you're still part of community and that you then contribute to the community. And I love what I saw on the news about Good Swords, that is on TV1 at the end of the news at 7:02. And there, in this case, were two women. One was 100 and the other one was, I think, 87, if I remember well. They were both knitting, and they were knitting for children in other communities, in other places in the world. And they both were so exquisite about their sense of purpose and meaning. And they both felt so alive because they did have meaning in life. And the piece about it is that when we have empathy and when we have compassion and we feel like we can make a difference, even if it is just to one person, that's enough. That when that is happening, that gives a very much a sense of peace in our heart and soul space. Something that money and belongings can't do in the same way. And so I thought that was a fabulous role modeling for many of us, these two women that I saw yesterday.
I agree. We need to have purpose. I am speaking with Lise Roots Alberts on life, death, grief, and transition. What are some of the ways that you feel that we can inspire people to make the most of life and be possibly excited or expectant of their new life or after transition? Because in our sort of material reductionist society in the Western world today, a lot of us don't see anything past death, where of course most societies around the world have always seen the other side, for want of a better word, as something that's so magnificent, it's beyond words to express. So how do we engender in people the concept or the idea that we are part of some magnificent unfoldment? Mm. And one door closes and another door opens up.
Yeah. Yeah, and if there is a belief system, a spiritual belief system, then that makes it easy because there's already a bridge of transition happening. When working with people who have the feeling that, you know, life's life and I'm born and then I die and that's the end of it, then that does not mean that life has no meaning. So what we can explore then, and what I often explore, is tell me about what has your passion in life, what has your interest. Who are the people you have loved? Who have you connected with? What do they mean to you? How have you felt you've contributed to life? And more, what can you do right now? So it's about being curious, not about going in there and saying, well, I think you should take up knitting or whatever, or you need to start making sculptures or anything like that, but more exploring to the wisdom in every person about how can you make meaning in this life. And for people who have a clear transitional belief system around consciousness that permeates way through the third dimension, it is about, the more meaning I can give in this life, then when looking back, it is a richness and a gift and a sense of humbleness probably too, into where next. And we don't know in an absolute where next. But having, for instance, in the Kubler-Ross workshops, always after 5 days, on the fourth day, after people had done expressed a lot of their pain, we would sit together in the group and we would invite people, as being facilitators, we would invite the participants to tell us about synchronicity, about consciousness, about awareness or coincidence, as people call it, about interconnectedness and also about near-death experiences. And it has been very, very often that it has been the first time people dared to tell their near-death experiences because they felt they would be shamed or they would be put down or ridiculed, or it felt so incredibly, what do you say, potent and magnificent and exquisite that it was hard to find the words for it as well. So, yeah, my sense is clearly death ends a life, not a relationship or interconnectedness. But that's my belief system, and I'd be the last one to put that on by anybody else, you know. That
I understand, because there are so many stories of out-of-body experiences and near-death experience,
yeah.
And they're so clear that no one can deny that they didn't experience these things. They describe everything they see so clearly to, right, coming back to, say, the hospital bed. But prior to that, they know that they're far greater than what they are, what they thought they are. And so, of course, this is where there's an extension of what happens after life. And you would have heard many, many stories. I mean, I know, I remember flying with a person, going flying with them in this microlite, and we had a whole lot of instances there where we could have crashed and we didn't. But I remember him driving back to Auckland, and while we were driving along, just before the Harbour Bridge, I remember we had this flash come through, and he and I were Roman legionnaires or foot soldiers,
right,
together. And it was really interesting because the next week he went flying and he killed himself with another crew member. And there was some synchronicity there. Mm-hmm. There was this flash. And I've had this happen with other people around me too, that we realize that we're an extension of something that's far, far greater. Mm-hmm. And Elizabeth Kubler-Ross hinted at it many times. And there's been many different scientists. I mean, Ken Ring and even Raymond Moody wrote books about this. There's obviously a far more extensive existence than what we lead in this present little snapshot of life.
Yes, and the wonderful thing is that now in third era medicine, where we've been so relying on evidence-based medicine, evidence-based research, things like that, into neurosciences as well, there is more and more evidence coming out that around precognition and around the power of prayer, in whatever form that might take, around that interconnectedness and that consciousness that permeates everything. I've just been to a conference in Auckland last week called Spirituality, Science and Consciousness. And for instance, Larry Dossey has done a lot of research around this and has written about it extensively. And it's fantastic to see that which actually, when I've been working with other cultures who didn't have this evidence base, have talked about this for eons and have always had a sense of knowing about it, that it now gets underpinned by the theoretical-based evidence. It's been around, of course, always. And the wonderful thing is that it is getting more recognized, it's becoming more mainstream, and hopefully that will lead to less splitting off of, you know, what now is often called, oh, well, here are the flaky people, here are the scientific people, and there is a big rift between those, and never the twain shall meet. And I think one of the people, I was just recently reading quite a lot of material around Albert Einstein, who's spoken these superb messages around science and consciousness and spirituality. And I think we can learn a lot from that, really. Yeah.
Yes, because Marilyn Schlitz was there as well.
Oh, she was, yes.
And it was interesting because she was talking about Captain Edgar Mitchell, the sixth man on the moon.
Yeah.
And he had a whole lot of telepathic experiments going from the moon to people down on Earth. And he had about a 63 to 69% success ratio.
Yeah.
And when he came back, he realized that everything was not only energy, but everything was consciousness. Mm. In that, in actual fact, the universe is all consciousness,
yeah,
and we are energy fields inside this greater universal energy field. And so really it's where we focus our attention in a pure light, then there's a far greater chance of us being able to make that jump or make that connection and even manifest situations for ourselves. Mm-hmm. And so there's big shifts going on right now. We're looking at the old paradigm, which we're merging out of, which is very, very physical pain orientation. It's a 3D life. What you see is what you get. And with the new era, the third era, as Larry Doocy talked about, is that we are conscious beings in a conscious universe, and we can consciously create our way through life, that our body is in essence a light body of highly energized subatomic molecules, but even more so than that. And so where do you think it's all going?
Goodness me. I think that's a great adventure, really. You know, I wouldn't have a clue where this is going. What I do know is that to make a commitment to stay awake, because that's what it is about, not going asleep in this three-dimensional world, but to stay awake and to tune in and to be connected with what often is dismissed as coincidence, but what I'd like to call synchronicity. I once saw a sign next to a church that had said in big letters, "Coincidence is God's way of remaining anonymous." And I really liked it. I thought, yeah, whatever you want to fill in with God, that is where I would say consciousness in that. And where this goes, I think I am very hopeful about our more and more people being attuned to the effect of what I do for ill or good, that in turn will touch somebody else, who will then touch somebody else, until who knows where that ripple will stop, you know, and that we are all interconnected in that. And I think I'm very hopeful, really.
Well, it's like an infectious smile, isn't it, really?
It is like that. You want to smile back.
It ripples out.
Yeah.
Really does make a connection. And why I'm involved with this radio program is because the possibilities are immense. We have the capacity and the capabilities to be part of this magnificent unfoldment of consciousness of the human race realizing who we are. Because up until fairly recently, we've been sort of victims to circumstance. We thought everybody just did things and things happened. But now, because we've been able to use a lot of scientific methods, we see where we've come from. And we can now realize that we humans, we can co-create a new future. And this is why we're here.
That's right. And that is what gives life meaning, too. And it is for everybody. Where is my little piece? You know, and for me, it's only a little piece. I can decide, like I said before, to make my life a prison or make my life a school, where I'm learning and where I am sharing. And I think I can decide to be in relationship with everybody around me from a place of empathy and compassion, or I can decide to withdraw and be in isolation inside myself. And it's a choice that we all make. And each one can make only for themselves, I think. So I have no judgment about that.
Liz, you would have met some wonderful people. Can you tell one or two little stories just to let a little flower bloom at the end of this program?
Right, let me think. Well, maybe I'll tell Susie's story. And I have permission to tell these stories, by the way. Susie was a 14-year-old with leukemia, and she had been diagnosed many years before, and when I heard about Susie, she was dying, so there was no more heroic active treatment possible. And Susie's mum, Beth, came to one of the Elizabeth Kubler-Ross workshops. And she was in horrendous grief and despair, as you can imagine. I can only imagine what it is like to journey with your child over many years through so many treatments and things like that. And then at the end here, I'm very sorry. There's nothing else on a medical level we can do for you. We can make sure that everything's very comfortable. And so Beth was quite in despair, and this was in October, and she came to the workshop in a lot of pain and a lot of agony. In the middle of the night, she knocked on my door, and she said, "Can I talk?" And because I feel like I just want to kill myself, I can't handle it to see my daughter die. And at that moment, like always, you know, it catches my breath. I don't know what to do either. It's kind of, so I said, "Well, let's go to the kitchen. I'll make a cup of tea and let's talk." And so we did. And for quite a long time, she just poured out her pain. And at the end of that, she sort of looked up and said, "Okay, I think I've caught my breath enough and I'll go to sleep." So I tucked her in and went back to bed. And the next morning she came into the room where the whole group was. This was in Iowera in the Waitakere's. And she came into the room and she was radiating, which was very different from the woman who I had spent time with in the night. There was an incredible transition. Although at the end, after she had really talked in the night, she was not desperate really anymore, but she certainly wasn't radiating at all. She was radiating and she stood up and she told us. And she said, "I need to tell you," and thank God she did, because I was so curious. And she said, "I need to tell you that I had a vision last night." She said, "It wasn't a dream, it was a vision. And in the vision, I saw Susie. And Susie had become a fairy ball, a kind of, you know, fluffy seed ball that would float in the air. And she said, and in this vision, Susie was the biggest, fattest, beautiful fairy ball I had ever seen. And it was emanating light. And in this vision, Susie told me, 'It's all right, Mum. It is okay. Don't worry about me. When I die, I will be a beautiful fairy ball, and light will be emanating from me, and I will be dancing in the wind.'" And Susie had been a gymnast, and one of the biggest griefs that she had was that through her illness, she couldn't do any flip-flops and any tumblings anymore. And she said to her mum in this vision, "Mum, when I die and after I go, look, and I'll be this fairy ball, and I can do flip-flops again, and I can tumble and bounce and dance in the wind. It's all right, Mum. And when I've had enough, then I will float down to the earth, and a beautiful flower will grow out of me. And it will be okay, Mum." And that had been for Beth, that kind of thinning of the veil to what is now and what is next. And it became her comfort, and she told us about it. After the workshop, I had the privilege to meet with Susie. And Susie was this most feisty, exquisite, conscious 14-year-old. And Elizabeth Kubler-Ross, as a symbol, always had the butterfly, that we come through, we are a caterpillar, we go in the cocoon, and we transform into a butterfly. Well, Susie was not going to have anything to do with butterflies. She was going to be a dragon, you know, when she died. And she was also determined, this was October, that she was going to make Christmas. While the whole medical fraternity around her said, no, she's going to die much sooner. But Susie decided she wasn't having any of it. To cut a long story short, she lived until after Christmas. And before Christmas, we said goodbye. I met her for the last time and I went on holiday. And after Christmas, I was working with some other colleagues to prepare the next workshop. And at 4 o'clock in the afternoon, it was a summer's day, the biggest, fattest fairy ball I have ever seen came floating into the room where we were doing our work and landed in front of me on the desk. And I said to my colleagues, I think Susie's died, and I think she's coming to say goodbye. And so I let the fairy ball tumble in the wind and said, well, show me, Susie, how you're tumbling. And the fairy ball just tumbled. At 7 o'clock in the evening, Beth called me when I had got back home, and she said, Susie has died. And I said, yes, Beth, I know. Was it 4 o'clock? And it was 4 o'clock. And I said, yes, Beth, because she came to say goodbye. And that was such medicine for Beth. And it's been such healing and potent medicine for me as well. That's been the gift. And now, often when I'm in difficult places, difficult situations, a fairy ball comes floating in and I think, ah, Susie's here. Things will be fine.
Lovely. Thank you so much, Liz. It's important for us to realize that there's magic everywhere.
Absolutely, I totally agree, and you are so welcome, and thank you.
Very good. That was Liz Griet Albert on Death, Dying, Grief and Transition. On Grief, Death, Dying and Transition. Her website is LiesGrietAlbert.com. L-I-E-S E-G-R-O-O-T Alberts.com LiesGrietAlbert.com. At 9:05 Thursdays, this program is streamed from the Planet FM studios at planetaudio.org.nz. Search Green, and iPod and streaming can be obtained 6 hours after broadcasting on greenplanetfm.com, holisticliving.co.nz, and itunes.com, search health. I thank you for tuning into greenplanetfm.com, broadcasting here in Auckland and streaming out from nuclear-free New Zealand around the curve in the southern hemisphere of our magnificent home planet. The premise for this program is to uplift and mobilize consciousness and the human spirit and discover what we can actively do at a grassroots level to promote positive and sustainable alternatives to life on Earth, particularly in the immediate environment that nourishes all of us. In doing so, I trust that you will find this program supportive and inspirational as we listen to leading-edge experts, practitioners in their field, and people who are living examples of well-being, optimism, and sustainability. From the latest environmental solutions to issues of well-being, community development and consciousness, we take you through in-depth discussions and supplementary concepts rarely explored so comprehensively in mainstream media. Above all, we are an advocate for today's and tomorrow's children. When we consider our magnificent planet as a whole, we might realize that our perspective has only been informed and expanded for the first time since Galileo, when the Apollo space program in the 1960s took us to the moon and gave us the image of Earth floating alone in space. Now, as we pass beyond this first decade of the 21st century, humanity urgently needs to act with maturity, with easy access to knowledge and technology, and I trust deep wisdom. Will this new century mark our 21st birthday, a coming of age as an adult and mature civilization, being responsible, courageous, and compassionate, with insight, inclusiveness, and vision. For we are a young, recent, and supposedly evolving species physically on this Earth for less than 2 million years, at the evolving end of the long-term 4.5 billion-year scheme of things on this planet. However, we are now in rapid growth phase as a species that in the last 50 years is reaching exponential proportions. We are learning and experiencing far more and far faster than ever before. As this pace is quickening in complexity, there's a compelling need for simplicity and unity. all of us born here on earth have a yearning to enjoy a life of love, full of experience and fun, with both wonder and insight being part of our everyday growth. Furthermore, we are interwoven intimately with a colossal superorganism that is Gaia, planet Earth. This living planet has loaned us bodies in which we can co-evolve with her and co-create with each other. And so we live lightly embedded within this new paradigm, the unfolding of nature. Of all the times to be alive, this is the moment for us to accelerate our awakening and cooperate with our evolution. Let us access our latent virtues, which glow within us as subatomic energy bundles of luminescence. For we are far more than we ever thought possible. We are realizing that there is as much to know in the inner world as there is in the outer world. Never before in recorded history has such an opportunity been presented for humanity, both individually and en masse, to cross the threshold to the inner self. Can we now, at this moment, be present to our spiritual inheritance? Can we now take a leadership role in our local community while retaining our awareness of a larger global community and our destiny beyond? This is where we are at this instant. So thank you for tuning into this GreenPlanetFM.com program. I trust you feel empowered to make a difference, to play your part in this magnificent experiment called life, as it fulfills our purpose. I look forward to interviewing another insightful and perceptual practitioner next week. I wish you success in your work and your life. This is Tim Lynch, in the spirit of Aroha, south of the Tropic of Capricorn, saying bye-bye and haere rā.